All right, so I want to see balloons on every table. We got to make, hey, this thing's got to look bright and cheery. Let's get in here, get in your seats. No empty seats. Come on, let's get in here. Let's be committed. Hey, did you guys see how much energy was in the room last night? Why was that? Because we're engaged, man. We're engaged. Okay, turn your cell phones off. Let's engage. Because the next 90 minutes are going to be off the charts, beyond phenomenal. I want to point out two people to you, though, before I bring Joseph up here. Mrs. Phenomenal is in the house. There we go. And if you have not met our marketing director, Aliki, right here, be sure to see her on the break. Now, what have we been talking about over the last couple of days? Delivering a phenomenal service experience that Mercedes clients would be thrilled with, right? I don't know of a better person to talk about that than the man who has written the book about a world-class experience about Mercedes-Benz called Driven to Delight, a number one New York Times best-selling author, international branding expert, and the authority on customer experience. Please help me welcome Dr. Joseph A. Michelli. All right. Hey, we got some Elvis for you.
All right. Well, thank you. Please see. We got a lot to do. We don't have a time to stand around and clap, I'm telling you. First and foremost, I feel like I am kind of flummoxed, right? This is a shrine to me. Seriously, anybody who's ever gone onto a stage in the hope of inspiring like one person in an audience should pay homage to this particular man and to Tom. Thank you so much for continuing the legacy and helping everyone create great legacies. So thank you for that. So Howard Partridge has brought me back again. How many of you have actually seen me speak once? How many of you see me speak more than once? How many of you are wondering, why in the heck are you speaking at all? Okay, right? I mean, seriously. Well, thank you so much for being willing to do this. I commit to the following. In spite of the fact that I know, based on the work of the Zigglers, that I should be repeating my content so you can actually catch on to what I'm saying. And maybe if I repeat it enough, I can catch on to what I'm saying, right? As much as I know that's true, I'm really going to strive today to stay away from anything I've said before. How's that? Crazy or what? I really don't want to walk us back down and tell you a signature story in my opening or signature story in my close. So I'm taking a real risk with you today. I feel like I'm doing karaoke and I'm singing a song I haven't sung. Okay? Is that all right with you? Yeah, you'll find out in a minute, I guess, really. It depends on how bad that actually sounds. So let's start with what is the message then today and how does it differ from some other things? Well, first off, today's message is about persistently driving execution. That's the message of today. We're going to talk about how do we drive execution every single time. And the difference between great brands that get it right most of the time and exceptional brands that get it right every time or near every time that we can't even hardly think of when they don't, that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to also talk a little bit today in the messaging about who is it we want to engage in our business. And from a customer perspective, I'm going to focus on engaging profitable customers. If you don't want to hear about engaging profitable customers, I'm sure there's more fruit outside you can have and just step out for that. But if engaging profitable customers is relevant to you, then we're going to really dial in. What is the significance of engagement? And what is the profitable factor of this? Should we engage all customers in the hopes of them someday becoming profitable to us? Should we engage only the most profitable customers? Where is the sweet spot of engagement, and how does that relate to your book of business? We also want to talk about innovating in these times of disruptive and rapid change. This is a time in life, and I feel like it's a new frontier. It's a wild, wild west out there in disruptive technologies. We're going to talk about some of my favorite disruptive brands, the kinds of brands who have literally challenged an entire way service has been delivered in a particular sector. So we're going to get into some of that stuff. You're thinking Uber, that's an obvious one, but we're going to get more disruptive and some really crazy, weird stuff. You have to ask yourself, will anybody really buy this? And then on the other hand, think, why haven't we really had this, right? I mean, both of those things coming about in our conversation today. So that's where we're going to go. It's a little different than me kind of reemphasizing the strategy of product versus service versus experience. If you missed all those presentations around the significant differences between those three things, I'll be glad to catch you up in a break. But for right now, we're going to assume you're on this path to creating phenomenal experiences. I wonder why I would make that assumption. Well, the first perspective on success in this space is consistency, right? Executing on a consistent level, staying the course, fighting when others yield, being the one who says, one more time, I'm coming back, I'm not done yet. The ability to continue to strive to perfect execution with tireless energy. So you say, well, Joseph, do you know anything about persistence? I mean, like, are you a consistency kind of guy? Are you kind of inconsistent on your own? I mean, what are you on this space? So let me just kind of make one singular story case for why I might be a little bit of a tour guide into the world of consistency and persistence. So let's start with persistence. I wanted to be a doctor badly so that I could be taken seriously, and now look at where my career has fallen, right? I mean, seriously, I am so far from taken seriously, but I wanted to be taken seriously, and I somehow thought that if I had a PhD behind my name, I would be more gravitas serious taken, right? So I was all into that, and I applied to every doctoral program in the world, anywhere that would allow me to apply, I applied. I didn't care about language differences. I didn't care about culture differences. If I could read the application, I was applying. Lower Botswana State would not scare me. I wanted to be a doctor. I was going for it. I got my very first letter back in this journey to being a doctor. And the letter came from the University of California, Los Angeles. And the letter read like this. Dear applicant, we're sorry to inform you, you have not been accepted at the University of California, Los Angeles. Best wishes in your future career endeavors. Sincerely, John Michaels, Dean of the Graduate School. So how do you end up feeling if you just lean into that? Y'all are phenomenal. You've never been rejected, I can take it. Is that what I'm to conclude? Right? So I'm feeling rejected. I'm feeling hopeless. I'm feeling helpless. I'm feeling despairing. I'm feeling that cycle of thoughts. I call it CTD thinking, circling the drain thinking. I can almost hear the toilet flush on my life. I'm just thinking my way down the pathway of hopelessness. But I said, no, Joseph, it's about persistence. It is about persistence, isn't it? When you get the no, it's a maybe. So I wrote a letter back to the University of California, Los Angeles. And my letter read, Dear Graduate School, please accept my letter of rejection of your letter of rejection. I look forward to attending on the first day of class. Yes, sincerely, applicant Joseph Michelli. So what do you think they did in response to my letter? They wrote me a letter back. And their letter read, Dear Mr. Michelli, now we're getting somewhere. We are somewhat confused by your most recent correspondence. To the best of our knowledge, in the history of this institution, no one has ever rejected our letter of rejection. Then in the letter, there was an underlying sentence that said, for the sake of clarification, there is no room for you in our incoming class, and you will not graduate. Sincerely, John Michaels, Dean of the Graduate School. So what do you think I did? Amen. Now you're in the program. I like this. I feel the spirit of dedication and persistence in the room with me. And yes, I wrote him back and my letter read, Dear John. Sir, it is you who is confused. And for the sake of clarification, underlined, there is no room for me in the incoming class. Fear not, I don't take up a great deal of room. And John, come graduation time, someone's going to fail. I'll just fill in for them in line. Love, Joe. So what do you think they did? No, they did not write back. It was getting way too urgent for that. He called me. And John said in so many words, we think you need a psych program, but it's not going to be here at the University of California, Los Angeles. which was perfectly okay. Because the day before I received that rather rude call from John, I had been accepted across town to the private school. Not the public dump that can't make it to the Rose Bowl. Not that I harbor any hard feelings toward UCLA to this day. UCLA stands for You Can't Learn Anything. That's what it stands for. No, I was accepted the day before I received that rather rude call from John. I was accepted across town at the University of Southern California. Yeah. USC stands for University of Spoiled Children. That's what it stands for, right? So just to kind of make this point really clear, even though I was accepted at USC, and even though John had rejected me, I was attending school at USC, and I stayed friends with John. Because persistence has its benefits, right? I stayed friends with John, and I would slum out of my neighborhood to go hang out with John. My neighborhood was basically around USC Watts, right? I would slum out of Watts to go hang out with him in Brentwood, Beverly Hills, and Bel Air, where he was located. And while attending a luncheon with John a couple of years later, he said, Joseph, do you remember when you applied here? I said, of course, you took such a personal interest in me. Said, let me tell you the rest of the story, as the late Paul Harvey would have said. He said, Joseph, we had a meeting between the psychology department and the Department of Security to discuss what would happen if you showed up on the first day of class. You can't take your life lying down, folks. This business thing that we're in is not a one-week trial offer. You know, this is the challenge of your life. This is the opportunity to be significant. In the words of a Tom Ziegler, it is the opportunity to be significant through consistent, dedicated effort. And brands that say, I am going to execute, win. I talked to Tony Hsieh when we were working on the Zappos Experience book. He's the billionaire owner of Zappos. And he's an owner in the sense that he sold it to Amazon of late, but really owns the experience and the leader and really one of the primary drivers of its success. And I said, geez, Tony, we're getting really close to giving away the entire farm here. You know, I feel like I'm telling insider secrets in the context of this book, and I don't think, are you really sure we should tell them about what we're doing? And he said, Joseph, they can't execute. They, meaning the people that he's most worried about taking them on, he's not worried because he knows the level of execution that he has. He's not worried that most people will be able to develop a business that'll overthrow what he's got. He's also got an advantage in barriers to entry. But all of that said, his perception was, give it away. Those who will take and make something greater from it, all the better the world is. And for those who will take it and think they're going to steal it, they're not going to probably execute because they're going to think it's easy. And it's not easy. So the beauty of the story for me in USC is that you stay in this place of dedicated persistence, but persistent to what end? See, that's the interesting thing. I failed. If you really pay attention to the UCLA story, it's a disaster story in the end, right? I failed to get into UCLA. Okay, no matter how cute I tried to be, through my persistence, I never got into UCLA. That could be why I'm having a few issues with them today, right? Never got in, but think about what the problem was with that persistence. That persistence was about me. Like, I am so fabulous that even though you don't think I'm worthy, I'm going to convince you I'm that fabulous. I don't really care about you. In fact, I'd like to trick you into letting me in somehow, by hook or crook. I want you to fall for this effort to get in, even though you don't think I'm worthy. So guess what? Please take care of me, 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 me. And they didn't buy it. No matter how clever. They stayed in relationship with me through dedication. But you know what I learned by the time I got out of USC finally? My first job working for the Pike Place Fish Market in Seattle, Washington, guys who ultimately threw fish and engaged customers in a whole different way. I learned that my most powerful asset in the entire world was to help somebody else. It really wasn't about me. And the more I focused on me, the less successful I became. But when I start focusing on Johnny Yokoyama's success and then got to help him tell his story and really made sure that he was the hero of his story instead of saying, look at me, I'm somebody who helped. Look at me, I'm the guy. Hey, look at me. When I excluded myself from the conversation and talked about him, it was amazing how much attention came back to me. It was a really weird law of reciprocity out in the universe or something. I'm not sure. But some good things happened. And then the more I focused on how do we help tell the story of the greatness of the Ritz-Carlton and play a role in that whole thing. Goodness gracious, it came back to me. And finally, the pinnacle of all of this for me and the proof positive on how things are different when you're persistent and dedicated to the needs and wants of others was when I got this call. And the call went like this. Joseph, we would like for you to come and help us. We've just got a new building. It's fabulous, amazing. And we would like to have you help us create a better patient experience in this building. Would you be willing to come and help us? And if everything worked out well, we would really love it if you could help us write a book about our transformation. And I had to say, geez, do I say yes or do I reject UCLA as they approach me to help them with their healthcare system? Now, the beauty of this is I said yes. Now, thank you. The beauty of this is I said yes to UCLA. I said, let's take on and make this amazing hospital, the Ronald Reagan Healthcare Facility. Let's make this into world-class experience that does not let the building down. Let's execute customer service at a different level in healthcare. So amazing things happened here. They went from the 30th percentile in patient satisfaction to the 95th percentile in patient satisfaction. They have the number one patient-satisfying academic healthcare facility in the United States, bar none. They went from a time when patients would write to the CEO and say, "Hallelujah, I am healed. I have had a solid organ transplant. I am alive and I should not be alive. Thank you for the incredible clinical outcome you have provided for me, but I must tell you something. I'm not sure it's worth what I went through at your institution to still be alive." Now, when you perform a miracle for somebody and they're not happy about it, you probably have a problem with your customer experience. So they had that place a long time ago, and now they're holding this very preeminent place in history in how they deliver patient experiences in an academic, research, training, clinically extreme case kind of environment. They're delivering outstanding patient experiences. So I thought, wow, this is such a no-brainer. Now I can do the book. I can do the book. I'll do a book about UCLA. This is awesome. I then contacted my publisher, McGraw-Hill, they're an okay publisher. You've probably heard of them. You know, they've been around a couple of weeks. And I said to my publisher at McGraw-Hill, I said, "You guys have been so nice to me on Starbucks and Zappos and all these other cool books. I can't wait to tell you this story, because as cool as it is to share a story about Starbucks and how, you know, a barista can help somebody, you know, overcome some sense of loss by the daily ritual of knowing them, that's a great story. But let me tell you, we got life or death in the balance, and here's UCLA transforming life or death, stepping into the breach in the darkest moments and hours of people's lives. Wow, this is a story. We got to publish this." And my publisher said, "Okay, let me get this straight. You want to talk about great experiences in healthcare?" "Yeah, right. Well, are you going to bring us a book about airlines next, Joseph? Maybe some cable company books would be really, really good to create while you're on this mythical journey of book writing. Did you cross over to the fiction section? I mean, where did you go?" I said, "No, you got to understand, this is an incredible story. This is the crucible of life." They said, "I'm sorry. I mean, it's the crucible of your death as an author if we publish this thing, because nobody's going to buy a book about healthcare excellence. Nobody's going to believe that that's happening in America." And I said, "Okay, so what can I get you to do to be willing to do it?" He said, "Well, you take a risk on it. You give up all your money to write the book, to give up your royalties on writing the book, and we'll consider it." Well, that's putting a little deeper step on how dedicated and persistent you are on some topic. Particularly for UCLA, I'm about to give up my royalties for UCLA, who thought me unworthy. So I said, "Okay." I said, "I'll tell you what, I'll pledge my royalties for this book to the Wounded Warrior Fund at UCLA, which is called Operation Mend. We'll let any royalties from this book that I would otherwise be entitled to go to Operation Mend to put faces back on soldiers who had them blown up from IEDs in the service of us with the ultimate of dedication. I will commit my royalties if you'll publish it." I said, "If you want to do that, we'll consider." Well, they still weren't willing to go all in, so they had to co-publish it with a healthcare specialty publisher called Second River. So we put the book out. It is my single most successful book of all time. It was my first New York Times best-selling book. Outperforming the Starbucks experience, which was a dream book for me. And the cool part of me about this book is persistence in the service of others continues to serve others.
And persistence in the service of self is a pretty empty world. I'm asking you, are you willing to drive down in tireless execution? Are you willing to leave here and say, I don't care how good I was yesterday, I got to double down today? Are you? Did I hear a yes? That's good. I like yes. Yes is good. Thank you very much. Well, here's why I'm a little suspicious, though. Because let me tell you, everybody says yes, really. At least 92% of corporate America right now is saying yes to the following. Should customer experience improvement be on our strategic priority list? The answer is yes, 92% of the time. Can you believe corporate America today, 92% of boards, leadership teams are saying among our strategic priorities, whatever the mix is, one of them is going to be improving the client or customer experience. Makes sense, right? I mean, what else do you have to differentiate on the basis of? After a while, all the products get more and more alike. After a while, customers come to expect whatever's going on, and the only way you can differentiate is if you find a new way to do something that serves a customer need. Of course, it's going to be a priority 92% of the time. So why is it that the American Customer Satisfaction Index, which measures customer satisfaction, is at a near all-time low, and certainly a low for the last 9 years? Why is it that everybody seems to say they want to deliver greater customer experiences, and so very few people do something about it? Mark Twain is quoted as saying, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it, though someone suggested that might have been taken from someone else. Just reproportioning some wisdom, I suspect. And so here it starts with, if this is what you want to do, tirelessly execute against it, then we need to make sure we communicate the vision of that to every single person who works for us. And herein comes the story of Mercedes-Benz. Mercedes-Benz, we would think, probably had a great customer experience all along, right? I mean, come on there, Mercedes-Benz. Well, the fact of the matter is, when a guy in 2011 came to the helm of Mercedes-Benz, the new president of Mercedes-Benz USA, Steve Cannon, came to the helm, he took a deep look at how well they were delivering the customer experience. He, too, said it was going to be on their strategic priority list. In fact, he said it would be our number one priority. He claimed that would be their vision for the future, that they would deliver the ultimate customer experience. Now, let's talk about this. Vision is something that every leadership training course talks about, like your leadership vision, like articulate your vision. Make sure that your vision is crystal clear for yourself and then be able to not only lead yourself but lead others in the pursuit of that vision. That's like basic 101 leadership. The problem is, if we really look at how vision manifests, there's a really important distinction to be made. It starts with this fundamental belief. Vision is only verified by how many people see it. So if you're the only one seeing it, what do we call that vision? A hallucination. Right? So the key to what we're talking about is, how do we get more people to see our vision? So how did that get done at Mercedes-Benz? That's what we're going to use as our teacher today. So let me operate on one fundamental assumption. You are not Mercedes-Benz. I'm going to start with that assumption. If you are, please forgive me. In addition to that, you probably don't have the size and scope and scale of a Mercedes-Benz. I'm going to assume that. I'm also going to assume you've not been in business as long as Mercedes-Benz has been. We're coming up on, 100 years of brand. That's probably a little longer than most of you. So there's some differences that I assume. So everything we talk about Mercedes-Benz, I'm going to try to bring back to you and say, well, how does this relate to a mid-sized business? How does this relate to an entrepreneurial phase business? How does this relate to a mature business that continues to try to aspire to the experience of customers, but not an aged, long-term, equity, slow-moving business? All right? So let's talk about the shared journey that Mercedes-Benz took to create its vision and where it went. So here's the foundation of this vision. Mercedes-Benz's greatest strength was their greatest weakness. Their greatest strength was how good they were with their product. If you really love your product, sometimes you fall deeper and deeper in love with your product to the point where you forget about the fact that it's not your product, stupid. Your product's part of the formula, but it's not the be-all, end-all. You saw in times of deep economic challenge, lots of people started to run back to the cover of their products. So let me tell you about my benefits and attributes of my products. Let me tell you more about my benefits and attributes of my products. Well, guess what? A lot of people had similar benefits and attributes. It was harder to sell them. The challenge was, how does this product get delivered to you in a way that improves your life, and how is it in the delivery I add value to whatever product exists? And so there came the challenge for Mercedes-Benz. They had neglected the customer experience most of the time. In fact, if you talk to some customers about 2011, they would say the following. You know what? I went to dealerships, and they treated me as if I was lucky to have the car. Like, I should endure whatever they put me through because I had the good fortune of having this amazing engineering from Germany. Well, get over yourself. Or you would have talked to an emerging millennial population just beginning to really start to get into this buying stage, and they'd say, wow, what's with this place? I mean, this is about the most off-putting route. I mean, if I don't dress a certain way, they don't even give me service. And you had all of these people who rejected the Mercedes-Benz brand being interviewed by J.D. Powers. And guess what? Any rejecter of the brand who'd had a shopping experience and went and bought somewhere else gave such a low mark to Mercedes-Benz that their ranking on J.D. Powers was substantially affected by that arrogance. So, what do you do with it? Well, you create a vision. But how do you make the vision see? How do you make sure that the people who you want to have the vision with you see the vision? So here's what they did. They literally made the vision see. And here's where I think we have some opportunity as a small business person. You probably have a vision. You probably have spent a lot of time in your leadership work with your vision. You probably got it. Oh, by the way, take all the pictures you want of the slides. Embedded in the slides every once in a while, you'll see a code where you can just text it. I don't sell anything. I'll be really honest with you. I don't have an offer, nothing. I'm just being really clear with you. But what I do have is the opportunity to at least once a month give you a free newsletter, and that's about all the more we'll hassle you, seriously. We don't solicit you for anything else, but you do get the download of the entire deck. So if you see that text message number on there pop up, then just write it down. You can either download the deck to your phone, or you can wait till you get back to your hacienda and download the deck there. Okay? It's a PDF. All right, so let me talk to you about this vision. So let's assume we've got our vision of what we want our future to be. I'm looking out to the year 2020, and this is what I see our company. This is what I believe we can do. This is how we can be successful. This is how we can be significant. This is how, by our collective effort, we can do something remarkable from this place we call our business. But how do I make sure that everybody gets to see that? Well, if you're good with words, like Zig Ziglar was, or Tom Ziglar was, or Howard Partridge is, you can paint a really beautiful word picture, and lots of people love word pictures. If you really like to read a lot, you can create a really powerful white paper explaining all of your positions. You write well, and other people love to read well in your organization. That's a declining art, both on the writing and the reading sides. I don't spend a lot of time with that. I love the references to infographics. We do an infographic every week as part of our blog series, and our infographics get hit lots more than our 500-word blog does, because 500 words is a lot of words for people to have to put into their psyche with so much other information out there. But an infographic graphically captures the essence of that every single week. And so I believe pictures matter, and icons matter, and little images matter, and people can continue referencing back to it. So at Mercedes-Benz, they did a leadership retreat. They looked at where they wanted to take the brand in the future, and they identified it, and they created a map. And that map, which is in the book, but also, you know, exists on a website, and you'll have it in the deck if you download it, it's just really simple to help you look at. The map says, here's where we are today. It's kind of a SWOT analysis in the space of customer experience. Here's where we are today. We've got pretty good buildings. I mean, they had refurbished all of the Mercedes-Benz dealerships to the Auto House complex so that they looked more beautiful than the varied brand representations they had in them. We have pretty good buildings. Our sales numbers are pretty solid, so we have some revenue that we can help our dealers help invest in our initiative to deliver a better customer experience. Our customer experience is not awful. I mean, we don't have to be completely embarrassed. They're much worse, but it's really, I mean, the way they put it on the slide is it doesn't suck. It's hard to imagine Mercedes-Benz speaking like that, but that's the way they describe at a leadership level. Pretty straight talk to their employees. We don't think it sucks, but we don't think it rocks either. So how do we make it go from here to there? So that was the current state. Then they said, okay, let's fast forward to 2020 and let's imagine what kind of world we're going to live in then. What are customers going to be saying about us in social media in the way they're not saying about it today? What is their loyalty level going to be like? What's our sales numbers going to hit? If we literally could transform the experience so that we got more referrals from people and people actually enjoyed coming in instead of dreading the visit to the car dealership. So they created the visual. on that. Then they said, well, there's a big gap here between 2020 and where we are right now. So what are some of the things we think we're going to have to do? And we're going to go over some of the things they did do because it relates to things you can do. And so they created the gap. They gave some idea of how they might bridge the gap. It's not hopeless. We can get from here to there. And here's some of our initial ideas, though we know this is going to be subject to change. Because once you get on the road, sometimes things change a little bit up ahead. May need to take a detour here and there, but we're still going to get to the destination. And so they created a vision of that. And then they had this cool thing. You can hardly see it in the graphic, but in the very front, you can almost see a dump truck in the front. They had a dump truck that they put in there, and they said, you know what? In order for us to really achieve what we want to do, we know some of the things we're doing right now have to go. Because what we're doing right now did not already get us there, right? I mean, if we'd have done everything that got us there, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So some of the stuff we're doing, we have to offload because it's not contributing to value. And for everything that we offload, that gives us more space to create the kinds of experiences that make us live our vision in 2020. Capisce? All right, good. Wow, this is a multicultural audience. Since I'm only Italian by nature, I don't have a lot of other languages to bring up. So if you can add value by just contributing other languages. But then again, I don't know what you're saying, and it may not add value. I will never even be able to tell. Okay, so suffice it to say, we need to look. If we're going to say, dream with me. Dream with me. Then we also have to say to our people, what do I need to get rid of that's holding you down from being able to fly up to that dream, right? What is it that I'm weighting you down with? Because the notion I can just add more dreaming on top of you and you can somehow fly, it just weights me down more. I got to fly by releasing some of the weights on my ankles. And so that's a part of the messaging that was clearly in there. And I'll show you in some specific examples how they released things that did not drive one of our key points today, profitable customers. How they released things that were habits and patterns in their business that did not add value to profitable customers. All right, so to create urgency around any kind of vision, you have to say, hey, you know what? It's not just a matter of you kind of want to do it with me or not. It would be kind of nice if we did it, don't you think? That's my vision. Hey, you want to play? You got to pretty much say, if we don't do this, something either terrible is going to happen to us or something fabulous is going to happen to us if we do it. And so Mercedes had a pretty good platform. They could say, something terrible is going to happen to us. Nothing terrible has happened to us yet. Let me be really clear. They could say, so I know you might not believe me, but let me just show you something. This is where we are in customer satisfaction relative to our competitors. The year 2010, Mercedes-Benz was down there, in about the 16th, I guess they were 9 position by 2013. So they must have been about 16 in 2010. But back in 2008, they were 22nd. In customer satisfaction among all automotive brands. Think about this. It's hard to get excited and saying, hey, woohoo, we just beat Mazda, right? I mean, that's kind of where they were. It's that Charlie Sheen winning thing. We're winning. We beat Mazda. I mean, it's not winning. I mean, so what can we sustain this forever, do you think? This kind of trajectory, that 8, 9, 10, 11 sort of positioning and customer satisfaction. What do you think that means when we are ranking so far below competitors, not only in luxury but in other spaces? What does that mean? That means that sooner or later, if customers perceive that products are comparable enough on performance variables, they're going to differentiate on whether or not they've been treated nicely here or not. When brands like Lexus came into the world and they said, you know what? We are Japanese. We are not German. We believe we have different kinds of value propositions than the German engineering, but we also know we're going to engineer the customer experience. And we're going to take the best Toyota dealers in the world and we're going to give them an opportunity to represent our higher-end brand, which they hadn't even named yet. And in fact, their original name for Lexus was Alexis, but unfortunately there was a television series that had a high-level character named Alexis. It was not a favorable character, and so they decided that maybe they should make up an artificial name other than Alexis, and they chopped off the A at a marketing retreat, okay? This brand came to be not because of Gottlieb Daimler, who then got together with Carl Benz, and they created Mercedes-Benz in the first automobile. No, it had none of that rich legacy. It was a manufactured, branded marketing phenomena which was going to take the high engineering of Toyota and put it up to another level. It was going to challenge over time the engineering of the Germans, but at the very onset, it was going to deliver a differentiated experience. So unlike Mercedes, had been in this country for generations, and dealers' grandchildren were running dealerships. Grandpa was long since gone from doing personal business, and the grandkid could care less about delivering service. He was just getting the royalty checks from the sales of these things every year. Lexus was cherry-picking the best customer service folks, and they said, in fact, you have to sign a covenant on behalf of the customer. We have a manifesto of how we expect you to treat the customer. So from the beginning of Lexus, they had already created it. Now here's Mercedes-Benz playing catch-up to the tune of 9. And so the CEO says to you, look, we got the best product, and we are 9. We claim to be, in our brand representations, best or nothing. We aren't best. Leave the rest to your imagination. Over time, we will be nothing if we don't fix this. Are you willing to play? That's the question they asked the employees. And then, to cement the deal, they went for the juggler. Because you can intellectually show the charts all you want, but you better grab them by their heart. You better tell your people, you know what, here's our factual, you know, right brain reality of where we are, but let me also tell you emotionally, we have a reason to take on this challenge. Here's how they use the advertising power of Mercedes-Benz, and instead of advertised, invertised to their employees to win the hearts and souls, to take the hill that the vision predicted. Maybe the lesson we learn from that is that we need to deeply think through the emotional resonance that we can appeal to for people and say, you know what, we got a need on a practical level. And you know what? We can do something extraordinary as human beings here. We can do something that's phenomenal as people here. Do you want to take on this challenge? Look at what we might become if only we were to. It sounds like something that Howard might say privately to somebody. You know, what would happen if you actually engaged the Ziegler training every single day for a year? What might happen? What could be possible? It's that kind of dreaming of a world where, if only... if only we would put the same kind of backbone into what we do with customers every day as we did and how we designed the cup holder in that S-Class, what would we be capable of? And if we don't, we got problems. We got problems because there's a whole generation of people coming in right now who want something more. And we need to anticipate their needs, or they may never drive cars. Millennials, ride sharing, living in urban environments. Why do I really need a car anymore? I mean, why are people waiting? When I was 16, I was like, it was midnight. I was at the DMV going, all right, I'm ready. You can all let me in anytime now. I've been reading the book for the last 4 years. I'm ready to take my test, right? Whatever. That generation has changed, delaying the onset of driving. There's so much going on there. If we do not figure out how to create experiences for millennials, we're not going to be able to win them into the business. And so lots and lots of data suggesting that millennials may not want to spend a whole bunch of money unless there's a good experience attached to it. If you look at the Boston Consulting Group, they're saying millennials will be more interested in experience and product in the generations to come. And if you look at the way lots of businesses are creating their work now, they're really creating interactivity, lots of touch zones, lots of things that pull me into an experience, not make me an outsider to a transaction. It's where we need to be thinking. And Mercedes, a lot of that thought went into making sure that we honored the times of millennials. If you're actually going to get out of your house and disconnect from your technology long enough to engage a human being in our environment, we better honor your time. We better make sure that this is as efficient as possible. We need to make sure that you're not speaking to a salesperson for more than 30 minutes, that the deal is concluded within a 30-minute time window. That means we have to use a lot of technology also to make sure that they see that we're tech savvy. We need to engage them socially. We need to be everywhere they are. When I launched the book campaign, we did all kinds of things with Mercedes on their social channels, taking pictures of me hanging out with the car and the book on the side of the car. It's just mostly it was the car, and the book was kind of hanging out as a side prop. But it was amazing the level of engagement that has taken place over the recent past. And finally, we need to give them a story to tell, because they're going to, and we need to make sure they have a story to tell in 140 characters, right? And we need to make sure they have a story to tell with a picture. I would ask you increasingly to think about executing a vision with your people that says, what would people take pictures of if they interact with us? How do we take pictures of them interacting with us? How do we make sure they have a picture to share in every single interaction with us, because otherwise they didn't have an experience. Today, the only way you can prove you've ever had an experience is if you have a selfie. Otherwise, if you don't have a selfie, you didn't. It didn't happen. I don't care. If you were standing next to the Pope, you tell friends, they go, "Where's the selfie? Where's the picture?" "I was with the Pope." "No, sorry. Until you show me a photo, I don't believe you were with the Pope." Yeah. It's become crazy that we have to verify everything through pictures. Why not give them something worthy of verifying? So the discipline path. The discipline path that took Mercedes-Benz from 22nd to first. Oh, I gave away the secret. Dang. Yes, they got number one in J.D. Powers. What's the discipline path? It's a multi-year path. It's a multi-year path around people, process, and technology. It's a multi-year path that says if we are going to execute in successful businesses, we need to inspire our people. We need to investigate every single process and get rid of the stuff that doesn't work and increase the efficiency of things that do work and find new processes to solve customer needs. And we need to make sure we have adequate levels of technology in play to expedite the things that don't need people. Now, I was talking to Howard before, and I said, you know, we both have a very similar view. You were an antagonist. Who did you, Vaynerchuk, is that who you got in the grill of? And you know, leave it to Howard to be shy and retiring. So I guess he was at an event with Gary Vaynerchuk. The first man to pop up and ask a question was, you know it, Howard Partridge. And so, you know, Vaynerchuk's all about, you know, social and the ability to immerse. And so, and he's just so into that space. And Howard's like talking about, well, what about real connections, you know, beyond the technology connections? And I guess it just really made Vaynerchuk go more into his technology space because that's his solution. And I was talking earlier today, kind of in my world, about Zuckerberg, who's now saying that all service is going to be automatic in a generation from now. Artificial intelligence will take over all functions of the service delivery. I said, really? It's going to welcome us all? I don't, any world where technology is all that welcomes me is a hostile world I will never feel welcome in. Right? So our opportunity is to realize there's a whole bunch of things we can automate to make the life of a customer better, but we cannot delegate opt-out human. Right? We will never be able, I think, in our lifetimes to say, you know, there isn't value, Matt, in me looking at you and saying, thanks for being here today. I'm going to be hard-pressed to believe that any artificial intelligence is going to convince you that you are really welcome here today. Right? And so the message we had in this world is we had to figure out where we need to put technology and where did we need to be able to put people and how did we help people play with technology nicely so that I could turn on the technology for you when you needed it. For example, if you had already been talked to 15 times in the dealership and now you're about to go into the finance department, I should not be filling out paperwork. I mean, you got all that stuff up there. Why am I filling out paperwork again? Why is the finance guy asking me my name? I mean, some of that stuff we can automatize, but we should still make sure there's a person in the finance office, not just a technology that handles all of that. All right, let's take a look at this discipline journey. Multi-year tactical approach, people, process, and technology. Starts with people. So, again, we're going to do it on the mass scale. We're going to do it on the Mercedes-Benz scale, but then we're going to take it back to you. So, if you remember on that video, it said every employee in the brand would be trained. I loved when Tom Ziegler was talking about the opportunity to do an offering where your entire team could get trained, right? I mean, this notion that somehow we can change our own patterns of behavior and not improve the lives of our employees to be able to reach their objectives and goals, that didn't make a lot of sense to me, but we needed to do the same at Mercedes-Benz. So on a large scale, the commitment was every single employee in Mercedes-Benz would be trained. Now, let's talk about how Mercedes-Benz operates. There's a small team, a few thousand people, who work for Mercedes-Benz corporate. And then there are tens of thousands of people who represent the Mercedes-Benz brand in the context of a dealership distribution model, right? So most of the people that we are talking about aren't really Mercedes-Benz employees at all. They're the employees of Howard Partridge's Mercedes-Benz Dealerships International, right? Someday Howard will own all the Mercedes-Benz dealerships in America, I assume. But you know what I mean? It's a dealership model. So the employees are the dealer's employees representing a OEM, original, you know, equipment manufacturer. And so what's this Mercedes-Benz going to influence the dealer's team? Well, guess what? All the training rolled out to all the dealers, every single employee at every dealership, provided by Mercedes-Benz, because if they were really serious about changing the focus, they had to train people on how to deliver the experience. They had to define the experience and brand the experience in order to train it. So the original brand was called Driven to Delight. And we say the way you get to delight is being driven to lead. And LEAD was an acronym that I will share with you momentarily. The Driven to the LEAD training, which the result of which would be increasing the delight of all customers who interacted with the brand, that training happened across the globe, 83 training dates, 23 cities, 11,000 plus dealer employees, 2,600 employees at Mercedes-Benz, all of whom were exposed to this. Well, that's pretty sexy. Little icons. It does look like an infographic. This is what LEAD stands for. Listen, empathize, add value, and then delight. That's what it means to be driven to delight Mercedes-Benz way. And then a lot of training. And what does it really mean to listen? You know, we are great listeners, particularly because we know we're going to have to say something, so we have to listen long enough at least to figure out what we're going to say. That's what makes most people a listener, right? I heard enough. I'm ready to talk now. I done plumb listened. Oh, you changed the topic after that first sentence? I didn't realize. I had just heard the first sentence, and now I'm still kind of back there. That's what I'm talking about. Listening to understand. Really listening. You know, Paul Tillich, the philosopher, said the first act of love is to listen. First act of leadership is to listen, in my opinion. It is through listening we can even identify where the vision should take the organization. It's listening starts it all. I mean, anybody who can go out there and do something without hearing something, I don't know where you're coming from. Sometimes we listen with our eyes. Sometimes we listen with our whole body. But listening to understand was the training. Lots of training on listening to understand. And then we got you intellectually. I understand you. I got the words. I got the concepts. It's all working for me right here. Now I want to empathize. So what's the difference between empathy and listening? Well, clearly a fundamental difference is the human connection. If I empathize, I form a hypothesis about what another human being might be feeling, not just what they're saying. So somebody could say, I'm a little worried about buying this E-class for my 17-year-old. I'd be worried about them buying an E-class for their 17-year-old, too. And out of my own reaction, it's like, what the heck are you spending that kind of money on your 17-year-old? I mean, what are they going to look forward to when they're 19? I mean, you got to give them a little life before you give them the big old taco, right? You got to let them work up to that. You know, that would be my personal reaction, but that's not very empathetic. I have no clue why they're worried. Why might a parent be worried about a 17-year-old driving at all? Any ideas? Safety. So that's a good one. We could empathize with that. What else might they be worried about? Like maybe giving them too much car for, you know, the 17-year-old? Either from a social value kind of thing like I was suggesting, or too much car just that maybe they don't need an E-class, maybe they need a C-class, maybe. I don't know what they're... But if I listen, I say, I get it. You're saying you are worried. I understand the words. I understand you intellectually. Now the question is, let me hypothesize about what you might be feeling. So I can imagine somebody maybe feeling concerned about safety and trying to find the right vehicle for somebody. I can imagine somebody trying to make sure their kid fit into the right vehicle for their need at 17. Does that feel empathetic to you? Like if I said, I could imagine somebody may be feeling this or maybe feeling that. And then the customer gets to say, yeah, it's the first one. Yeah, you know, I really do worry about safety. Well, wow, I guess we had a human moment there, didn't we? I kind of got you for a second. Beyond the words, I kind of understood the human condition. And oh, by the way, I hypothesized about it. I didn't say, well, I understand you must be feeling your teenager is going to crash off the side of a bridge somewhere and you're hoping that this car will be safe. I mean, you don't over... Oh, because this happens to me all the time now on call center calls. Do you ever have this happen where you call up like and you have a problem and they've got a script? So it's something like, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't figure out how to read the instructions. Oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. That's what the script says to say. You must be near suicidal. Please come down off of the building. No, I just called up. Well, maybe I should feel that desperate. I mean, I didn't realize that it was that bad. I just thought it was a little thing. But if you're saying, am I, you know, so it's authentically hypothesizing, not saying, I'm going to tell you what you're feeling. So a lot of work went into the listening, empathizing, and then a lot of work on adding value. I'd ask you today, how do you add value? Why should you be paid if you don't add value? Right? I mean, why should you be paid if you do not add value? Why should you make money? I mean, not always to the customer. Sometimes you're adding value in the value chain that ultimately results to value to the customer. Sometimes you're adding value to the coworker. Sometimes you're adding value to the people you mentor. Sometimes you're adding value to the people on your team who you're creating a vision and activating them to some success. There are lots of ways you can add value, but I'm asking, do you know if you're adding value today or not? If you look at all the things you do, help me identify things that you don't think add value, because we need to look at those processes. They may not. I might have to teach you how those add value. That may be part of my job as a leader, to show you that there is really a purpose for that. It may not make any sense intuitively, but here's how it plays together for the good of the organization and the person. And then finally, delight. And the lesson here was, delight is often the smallest things in the world. It's like a smile and said, thank you. It's like, I am really glad I had the chance to assist you from an authentic place in your being and said, you know what, if you ever need something again, I would welcome that opportunity to serve you again. We need to put that little bit of delight at the end. If we listen, empathize, add value, and delight, we are delivering delight, driving delight. We are driven to delight. We are Mercedes-Benz. We will change the world. And oh, by the way, I have a little visual there that just shows the wheel and how that can actually manifest at various stages along the interaction with the customer as they come in, as they progress through the interaction, as they close an interaction, as there's a call to sequel. All right, so that's good stuff. But you know, one of the coolest things in life is that people who are serving people and people who are getting served sometimes are different. And at Mercedes-Benz, it's more striking than anything else. It's also striking at the Ritz-Carlton. It's striking at a lot of brands. The people who get served and the people who do the service have a lot of things not in common. And because of those lack of commonalities, there can be a subtle disconnect. I can teach you that you should empathize because they're a human being, but look at what kind of human being they are. That's the point. Let's assume I am doing payroll for a dealership. And let's assume that I don't have a lot of customer interaction. I do payroll for the other employees in the dealership. But I'm walking into a Mercedes-Benz dealership to go to my office, and a customer walks up to me because I've got the wardrobe on that says I work here, and so they think they can talk to me, those customers. And when they talk to me, they say, hey, can you tell me something about an S-Class here? I'm really interested in buying it. And this person who drives a Honda Civic says to them, look, I'll get you a salesperson, okay? And they do, and they go back to their cubicle, and they say to their coworker, another S-Class customer out there, $125,000 they're going to spend on a car today. What idiots. I mean, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that people are stupid enough to think a car is worth $125,000. I mean, you have to have one gigantic ego to think that you need to drive a car like that. You must have no sense of self-confidence. You must be all show and no go. Oh, and by the way, then we give them some training that day, says, please be empathetic. Right? So guess what we had to do at Mercedes-Benz? We did some studies, and we found that 70% of people who worked in a Mercedes-Benz dealership had never spent a considerable amount of time inside of a Mercedes-Benz. Is that surprising to you? It kind of surprises me. There's a lesson here for all of us. Wait in a second here. It's coming. But 70% had not spent a considerable amount of time in a Mercedes-Benz. So guess what Mercedes-Benz had to do? If we want you to really be empathetic, we have to have you experience our product and fall in love with the product, because it's not all about ego and vanity and all those other things. There's some real product reasons people buy this car. And you still may think there's a little ego and vanity. That's your business. But in the end of the day, you might want to feel the car out a little bit and see how it works and see if maybe that doesn't give you a little bit more respect for the people who crave it. So, created a program called Dash. It's called Drive a Star Home. Drive a Star Home went like this. We shall let you drive Mercedes-Benz for multiple days, every employee at every dealership across the entire country has an opportunity and should drive them. Well, this seems easy, right? I mean, how hard could this be? It's Mercedes-Benz. They got a lot of cars out in the parking lot. All you do is just get some cars up and have your people go riding around in them. Seems easy. There are a few liability issues. There's a lot of issues on how many cars you're going to have moving out. I mean, it's a very complicated program to execute. In fact, you know how it actually got done? They had to sell these cars to Hertz. Hertz could then rent the cars back to Mercedes-Benz so that they had rentals available in all these places. They had to have a dedicated person making sure that everybody had access to the cars when they wanted them. It was a pain in the rear to create empathy. It takes discipline. It takes commitment, even when it's not easy. So, put all these people in these cars, and man, we got some amazing stories. People took their, you know, they waited to get the car scheduled until they had their wedding. They took their mom home from chemo in the car. They took their daughter to daddy-daughter dances in the car. There's something special about this car, apparently. And maybe the customers who felt something special about the cars were not all that different than them. Wow, so that's good, right? You do something good, you just do more of it. That's what I like to think. Let's do 2.0 next year. So Mercedes said, well, that's good, but is it ultimate? Does it ultimately get where we want people to get in an understanding of our value proposition so that they can deliver more connected, empathetic experiences? And the answer is no, we can do better. Let's take the best of Dash and let's create a new program. We're going to call it Brand Immersion. So here's where your chance comes in as a small business or medium-sized business owner. Brand Immersion. The Brand Immersion program at Mercedes-Benz is an iteration of Dash. Now, I was called in to be a consultant for Mercedes-Benz. I can talk about this. It's my non-disclosure agreement's all been agreed upon, so I can share. But I started working with Mercedes-Benz back in the days when Steve Cannon was just trying to figure out how are we going to really deliver this extraordinary customer experience. And so what I did when I first got there was bring in experts from outside of the industry. So I brought in my buddies from Ritz-Carlton and from Zappos, and we met with Steve, and we all got together, and we brainstormed. There's a lesson there. Benchmark others, spend time learning from one another, get out of your holy huddles, and get out there and talk to new people who can inspire and ideate in your space. So we did that. We brought in these guys, and so we got started in that zone. My next big journey with Mercedes-Benz is in this Brand Immersion Center. So I'm so passionate about it that sometimes I go on and on and on. So after about 4 hours of me talking about, y'all can knock me off the stage. Here's the Brand Immersion Center. If you were to be an employee of Mercedes-Benz at a dealership right now, instead of us bringing a car to you to drive 3 or 4 days, we'll bring you to Alabama. For some of you, that sounds like hell. For others of you, it sounds like heaven, right? Sweet home, Alabama. We bring you to Vance, Alabama, which is the location of the Mercedes-Benz manufacturing plant in the United States. When you come to Vance, Alabama, we actually bring you to Birmingham, treat you really sweet and nice, but we bring you over to the plant in Vance. And while in Vance, we're going to expose you to a few things. We're going to let you drive cars. Fear not. In fact, we're going to let you drive on a bank track on an AMG vehicle, not just your regular old vehicle, but an AMG vehicle. You're going to have a helmet on, and you're going to be in a bank track, and you're going to have an incredible performance ride. If that doesn't tell you there's something more to this car than just basics, nothing will. And then, oh, by the way, we're going to put you out on an SUV track, too. We're going to put you on an off-road obstacle course. That is petrifying. In fact, we won't even let you drive the car this time. We're going to have a professional driver take you down this road. There's one point where the professional driver cannot do it. You're at the top of an incline that is so amazingly steep. The driver will tell you that he will remove his hands from the wheel, and he will not be hitting the brakes because he could not regulate the wheel sufficiently to protect you. So here we go. Those who live are very inspired by the performance of the vehicle. The messaging is, we got some pretty amazing technology on board. You'll never test this in real life conditions, but we've got stuff here that you don't even understand. And so you might want to feel some pride in being a part of a brand that has that ability to deliver that level of safety on behalf of that 17-year-old kid who you need to empathize for when that parent comes in. Pretty good stuff. And then on top of that, we make sure that you get to see the manufacturing, the just-in-time manufacturing, a lot of high touch, a lot of high technology in the manufacturing side. We have a history museum of all of the innovations of Mercedes-Benz and safety and performance throughout all the years. And oh, by the way, we teach you advanced courses in
listening, empathizing, add value, and delight, because we don't go off the theme because we don't want to be flavor of the day with a new customer experience lingo every week. So we're going to stay and continue to build advanced skills in those four areas that we've defined it as critical to driving delight. So where's the take home from small, medium-sized business owners? Well, first off, you're probably not going to put people in off-road performance challenges unless you don't like your people. So what are you going to do? Well, hopefully you're going to say, you know what, I run a dry cleaner, and I know you were working at the dry cleaner yesterday, and you were so good over there, I stole you from them, and you're working for me now, but I want to erase your memory banks for what you were doing over there. I mean, not your technical skills, but I want to erase your memory banks. I want to tell you a story about what we believe in, about our level of passion for customer experience. I want to make sure you get to try some of your own. I want you to bring in a load of dry cleaning, just have it done here, because we do a really great job. So I want you to bring your own stuff. I want you to be a customer and experience the customer journey. I want you to understand that from this place, called our place, we aspire to drive delight, to nurture customers, to have people walk in and leave with a bigger smile than they walked in with, or create a smile that wasn't there. I want you to believe we are in the uplifting moments business. So when somebody comes in, you may not have a lot of time with them, but if you can just do something that for a moment makes their life better, that's the business we're in. And we also do dry cleaning, and you're going to get to experience that too. But that's what we live for. It's orienting people, their hearts and their minds, behind the message of we are a great brand, we have a DNA, we are aspiring to certain great things. And I just want to take a few minutes to make sure you get that. Mercedes-Benz, they'll fly you to Alabama to give you an enriched, deep experience within the context of the brand. All right. If you're not measuring the engagement of your internals, it's time to do it. Mercedes had really good employee engagement at their corporate headquarters, but guess what? They had no idea if their dealers were treating their people well. And so as we listen to them more in the context of training them about listening, empathizing, adding value, and delighting, we realize that a lot of the leaders in those dealerships were not listening, empathizing, and adding value to their employee experience. And because of that, we needed to try to get some metrics behind it to see what was it like. So Mercedes-Benz offered employee engagement surveys to all of these dealerships free of charge, along with coaching and counseling. If you were willing to let measurement of employee engagement happen, we'll give the tools free. All we want is kind of a top-line understanding of how you're doing. We don't want to get into the weeds of it all. We just want to know that this tool is available to you, and we'll give you coaching on how to drive higher levels of employee engagement within your building. And lo and behold, that was a hugely important strategy to helping create an engaging experience where customers could be engaged. They also realized that at the end of the day, what I think people like Howard have been teaching us all for a long time, leaders create cultures and leaders inspire teams and leaders get results. And they realized a lot of problems were happening in those dealerships, so they gave free leadership training to their dealers. Here, come and take our leadership training course. You probably don't have enough budget on your own in your dealership. We're going to give you free leadership training. And we think if you create better leaders, we're going to have better future customer experience. My favorite story of some of the challenges of leadership at a Mercedes-Benz dealer was just like this. It went, this guy said, hey, you know what, I got arrested on my first day at Mercedes-Benz dealership. Really? Tell me more. Yeah, it was really a nice lady who got me arrested. I mean, I don't feel bad about it. She's just, I got arrested. I said, what happened? He goes, well, I was shagging cars. It was my first day. I was shagging cars. I had all these keys. I'd go run and grab cars and bring them up. And the reception, nobody introduced me to anybody. I got hired, I went out onto, I was shagging, nobody introduced me. So the receptionist saw me running all over the place with keys, grabbing very expensive cars, and the police came to the lot and they detained me until they could locate my manager, who I couldn't remember because he never really spent any time telling me who he was. I couldn't remember his name. And finally we were able to get to the bottom of it, and I was released from handcuffs on the lot. That kind of dissuades you from feeling really a lot of love for your job. Developed really solid leadership training courses there. We also try to figure out that most leaders in organizations aren't titled. So at Mercedes-Benz, we had something called the Culture Champions Program. Basically, we had people nominate who in the work area is the most likely person to drive successful cultural change. We identified the culture champion. They got nominated by their peers. They got selected.
And then they were exposed to massive amounts of training about how to affect even greater change in their department. So let's assume you're working at a particular dealership in Houston. Then there's somebody in that dealership who's the culture champion, and they're not necessarily a boss. They're just somebody that people go to get inspired. And so we'd get that culture champion nominated, we'd select them, and ultimately we'd yoke them together in a network because community matters. We put them in a community of like-minded people, all of whom were challenged to improve the experience of customers in their environment. We'd give 30-day, 60-day, 90-day challenges. We'd yoke them together. They'd share their best practices. We created best practice workbooks. We exposed them to lots of information and knowledge. They got to hear inspirational speakers. Chris Zane of Zane Cycles, I mean, amazing. Guy comes out and gives quarters to the audience. Says, take quarters. The plate of quarters comes back. There's still quarters. And what does he teach? Most people aren't going to steal all your quarters. Most people self-regulate. Let's manage the people who steal quarters. Let's treat everyone else like they don't. We teach them that kind of stuff. We say, help your organization get the notion of abundance before scarcity. Make sure you drive an abundance message. Customers should be treated as if they can spend money, as if they're excited to be there, as if you are excited to have them there. And if you treat them like that, instead of telling them, please don't steal our quarters, you have a whole different kind of dynamic in the customer experience. That's what we got out of it. We got great examples. The challenges were amazing. They would talk to us about, oh, I just decided to create a window hang on the rearview mirror to show people that we clean their car just to make the value seem more salient to them about our service. Our customer satisfaction scores went up, particularly at handoff. So where they were rated for how well did they hand the vehicle back to you, just that little tag made service tangible in a way that created greater responses and scores, which helped the J.D. Powers, which helped the brand. And we had all kinds of stories of what people did. We had a really cantankerous person who, their car was way out of warranty. He said, I'm sorry, I don't care if my car's out of warranty, I want it replaced. But at some point, you know, like, okay, it's a 25-year-old car. We're not going to replace it. I mean, you are a successful businessman. We get it. You kind of know our predicament here. How can we work this out? What's really going on? What else do you need? And the guy said, okay, I'll tell you what. My dog just died. And my dog used to ride in this car. This was my last vestige of my dog. Wow, that's listening. And so we would tell stories of that. And guess what? They ended up making a charitable contribution to an animal rescue center. And the person bought a car from them. They didn't want a new car. They wanted somebody to care about the fact this car was associated with something they loved. And when we shared stories like that, we had those stories communicated back into the culture. And guess what? After a while, you win the hearts and minds of people. Okay, I won't bore you a lot with process strategies, but suffice it to say, all those people started to look at every process in the entire organization. They looked at how we launched vehicles, how long it took to fix something. They came up with rapid response teams that were challenged to make sure that every single person could have any problem raised, anyone could stop the presses, things could get fixed quickly, that people didn't hide behind emails if there was a problem, people didn't practice defensiveness and say, well, I checked out, it must be their department. They got together in a room, they solved problems at launch, whenever anything started to smell of a problem. They looked at the fact that this brand had so many inconsistencies in that deliverable that we had to fix in process. Remember, consistent execution is the differentiator. You know, for the longest time, you go to a Mercedes-Benz dealership, you could get any kind of courtesy vehicle. You go in with an S-Class, you could come out with a Hyundai while your car is getting repaired because that dealer happened to have a Hyundai dealership as well, and there were no Mercedes courtesy vehicles available, so they put you in their Hyundai. It's kind of a problem, particularly if you go to Beverly Hills where they don't have any Hyundais anywhere near their dealership. So what's the message here? We had to go back and fix the process. You cannot have courtesy vehicle program unless you put people in a comparable Mercedes-Benz. You have to have a sufficient amount of fleet. We have to make sure that you as a dealer get a break on that from the OEM. We have to partner together. But in the end, we have to fix that process because it's a pain point for our customers. There were so many others. Express service. Mercedes-Benz had confused for a long time that luxury equals slow. Let's luxuriate with our brand. I mean, Honda had express service like for 25 years before Mercedes-Benz decided maybe we should make our service lane have some express lube services and other general maintenance services. They had to, what I would say, create points of parity where they caught up with the experience of other brands. And then there are points of differentiation where you do things that nobody else does. They had to map their customer experience. You know, I'm going to be speaking with is it the 777 or the, okay. We spent a lot of time today talking about mapping. I mean, how much time do you spend really looking at your customer experience from your customer's vantage point? Do you have them layered out across all of the touch points with your brand? And then do you have that segmented by customer type? So this is a customer journey map for a lease customer, first-time vehicle purchaser on lease with Mercedes-Benz. That's what the map looks like. How long it takes in pre-sale, what do they look like, what do they look at on the website, blah, 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 blah. All the steps that get them into the dealership, the test drive, the negotiation, all the steps all the way out to repurchase at the end of the lease after having gone through a service relationship with the brand. Every touch point analyzed. It was a promise in the video. It was delivered. And that allows you then to translate it into ways that most people can leverage it, which is a simpler map, not quite as detailed as the last one, and say, okay, where do you play in adding value to the customer journey across the customer cycle with the brand? And then we spent time spending money hiring big-time, real-time data people like Medallia to come in and tell Mercedes when should they ask questions of customers along the journey. How did we do during this phase, or should we ask over here? When do we over-ask, and how do we make sure we get data quickly so that we can fix a process? And actually, if there's an upset customer, how do we pacify and resolve the issue for that customer? Wow, that became important. They never had spent any money learning. They would just drop in surveys, and they were telling people things like, you'll be getting a survey soon, and my children need to eat, and fives are the only way I can actually eat. Not that there's any pressure, you know, I have lost 50 pounds, but it's okay. Instead of doing that garbage, you might get a text message at the end of a service day, do we take care of everything? And if you say no, Mercedes-Benz started to send people out to your house at night if you wanted. If it was something we could resolve quickly, we started sending people out to your house saying, oh, we didn't get that caliper on your seatbelt thing. We're going to run right out to your house tonight. Holy manoli, no, don't come to my house. That's freaking me out. It's a little too much service. Thank you. Oh, and by the way, as we measured all that and we got data on it, guess what we linked it to? The money dealers made. So we called it a customer experience index, scores on that. All those numbers that we calculated, we call it a customer experience index. Scores on customer experience index, affected margin. So let's assume that Matt is really good at customer experience in his dealership. Whereas Bruce, sorry Bruce, even with the VIP label, you're not so good at customer experience at your dealership. So Matt is going to get his full margin on every car he sells. Whereas Bruce is going to have to give back some of his margin to Mercedes-Benz. Now, that's the way it used to be in the old days, but we also improved that a little bit. We said, Bruce, that'd be wrong of us to keep your margin just because you failed. We would like to take your margin and give it to Matt. So if you don't execute, Matt gets a leadership bonus for his excellence in the customer experience space. And lo and behold, we saw Bruce perform a lot better. I just want to be really clear. Bruce has really lifted his game at his dealership. So you can go and buy a car from him any day. It'd be fine. My point is, we didn't hold back breakage. We allowed it to be an ecosystem where the noble commitment to our vision was reinforced financially. And as much as I love dealers and as much as many of them really love customers, when we got the purse strings attached, they loved customers more. Final messaging here is they had to get all the technologies integrated as part of their leveraging. So the technologies integrated meant that they had to make sure that everything worked together. If you had a problem, we wanted you to online schedule an appointment. We wanted to make sure that when you online schedule an appointment, when we knew what the nature of your appointment was, we could tell you how long it was. We could also automatically get you a courtesy vehicle ready so you didn't have to wait. We had to integrate all kinds of back systems through technology in order to be successful. It really reminded us of the Seinfeld episode. I don't know if you remember it. Here it is. Maybe it's not. Is that volume? Am I pushing any buttons?
Oh, I'm sorry. We have no mid-sized available at the moment. I don't understand. I made a reservation.
Do you have my reservation?
Yes, we do. Unfortunately, we ran out of cars.
But the reservation keeps the car here. That's why you have the reservations.
I know why we have reservations.
I don't think you do. If you did, I'd have a car. See, you know how to take the reservation, you just don't know how to hold the reservation. And that's really the most important part of the reservation, the hold.
So we were finding customers who were getting, you know, if you look at it from the standpoint of the Mercedes-Benz dealership, we would poll the dealers and we'd say, do you have online reservations? And they'd say yes. And so what that meant was some of them had the ability for them to have a website so you could go online and you could look up their phone number and then call them. And that was an online reservation in their world. Others had mobile device reservations that allowed you to schedule your appointment, allow you to get everything taken care of. We ultimately decided as a brand we needed to solidify that so everyone would have a common experience. We called that digital service drive, and it's certainly where the world is today. If you're not making it easy for your customers through technology, they are going to go somewhere else. And if you don't believe me, just check out one of my favorite examples, which is the Domino's no-click app. It's just coming online now. Domino's has realized that millennials do not want to have to click to get a pizza. It's way too much. You can understand the trauma. So how it works now is we're creatures of habit. We eat the same pizza all the time. It's in our profile, so just assume that. So when you open up the app, it's just there. Then your pizza is ready to be ordered, and you have 10 seconds to not order your pizza. It counts down 10 seconds. If you do not stop the countdown in 10 seconds, your pizza is coming to you. The only way you cannot eat pizza is if you put out effort. Do you follow me here? Right? Where has the world gone? And as funny as that sounds, there's going to be a time in 5 years we're all going to be going around, can you believe that Pizza Hut still requires you to push a button to get your pizza? I mean, get real. Oh, there's one of those text messages in case you're looking for it. The goal here is to engage customers, but it's to engage the right customers. And the nobility of this is to realize that not all customers are created equal. As much as we want to be an egalitarian society, we have to do good triage with our resources. And so Peter Drucker has said that we are in business to create a customer, not in business to create a profit. I now say we are in business to create a profitable customer. Okay, because creating customers without profit is a way to do charity work, and it is valuable if you are in a nonprofit organization, but not necessarily what you aspire to in a for-profit organization. So most of the brands I know are looking at the reality of customers are in different spaces in our lives, and we need to encourage customers who are high cost to do business with to go elsewhere, because it's probably not our sweet spot. There is a, you know, I think when you're really young and hungry, you'll take any customer. I think at some point you realize you can serve some customers better than others, and some customers are better suited to your service. And so we spent a lot of time looking at that and exploring who is the optimal customer for us. And we went through a lot of, you know, persona work and got us there. You know, the goal for most of us is to retain the high-value customers, to maximize customer lifetime value, and to make sure that we reprioritize our business efforts in accord with the things that we know we can execute against in a cost and service delivery kind of way. And that really is evidenced, and I'll give you a quick example. It's one of the get-rid-of things in the truck at Mercedes-Benz. They used to give roadside assistance to anybody who owned a Mercedes-Benz vehicle. Guaranteed roadside assistance for life of a Mercedes-Benz vehicle. That means you might have bought that vehicle from somebody else who bought that vehicle from somebody else. You may have actually gotten it serviced regularly at Jiffy Lube. On the way back from Jiffy Lube, your car breaks down on the side of the road. You call up the number that Mercedes-Benz provides to any Mercedes-Benz owner, and they come and they tow you back to Jiffy Lube. There's some good money spent. So all that money is no longer available to that population. That program, that perk is gone. The money that was otherwise used for that is used for other things. They'll still do roadside assistance for me if you have any relationship with the brand, or you have any service relationship with the brand, or if you wish to be towed back to a Mercedes-Benz dealer. Any of those things will qualify you, but absent any of those things, you're not going to get the perk anymore. I work for Godiva, Godiva Chocolate. Yeah, it's a tough job, but I work for Godiva Chocolate. And they used to give a loyalty program that says, sign up for our loyalty program for free, come in every month and have a piece of chocolate. It was basically a license to get a free piece of chocolate every single month. There was no criteria, no skin in the game, no commitment to buy anything, nothing. The free line was so free that there was no encouragement to create a loyal customer base. They just created a bunch of one-piece chocolate-grubbing people. That's not how they view the customers. That's my take on it. So how do we solve for it? I love this. We need to drive change. In crazy disruptive change times, we have to drive change. And it looks a lot like this. Steve Jobs was challenged by a designer who had worked on a software alternative called OpenDocs. It was an alternative to Java. He spent 7 years of his life developing this incredible technology. And Steve Jobs said, it's a really nice invention, but it's not innovation. And this guy challenged Steve Jobs in an open forum, saying, Mr. Jobs, you have just taken 7 years of my life work and thrown it down the toilet. What he was going to say at the very end there is that I have a lot of scars attached to trying to create solutions that don't meet the customer where the customer is. It may even be a better technology. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't solve a customer need, nobody's going to buy it. It may have so many extra features that customers can't even appreciate or value, but if it doesn't meet a core customer need, no one's going to buy it. Your technology may very well be better. I may not even understand it. But it isn't better that we're looking for. It's connecting the customer need that we're looking for. So I just want to identify a couple of quick disruptors in the space that customers are experiencing today, just to get your brain thinking. Anybody know Casper? Casper Beds has completely revolutionized the bedding industry. There's a lot of similar emulators, but I think it gives us a lot of understanding of what customers want today. Casper Beds basically works like this. They know empirically that most people have had terrible shopping for mattress experiences. The average mattress shopping experience is get a circular in the Sunday newspaper with an incredible deal. You go in, they steer you away from that bed because there's not a lot of margin on that bed. It is a bait and switch draw. You go then and they show you a bunch of beds. They let you sleep on each of them for 30 seconds as if you're sleeping. You lay down for 30 seconds. They know there's empirical data to show that no one can tell in 30 seconds whether or not that's a bed for them. And in fact, there is plenty of literature to suggest there is no predictive validity of if you spend time on a bed in a showroom, you will like that bed. Oh, and by the way, they'll upsell you with models that don't match. They're going to steer you to the model that they want to sell based on inventory and where the markup is. And that's the world. So guess what Casper did? Casper said, we're going to create three beds, core beds that people actually want. We know what the technology is. We're going to send it to them half the price of what they're paying for the showrooms because we don't have the overhead in the showrooms. We'll send it to them. It's going to be in a box. It's really easy for it to pop up and pop open. It's mostly foam for an oak bed. It fits in that box you see there. It pops out of that box. It looks like a little thing that's emerging out of a cocoon. And you get the bed, put it down. You got 100 days. If you don't like it, guess what? They will let you put it back in the box, and they'll pick it up at your door, and they'll take it away. No questions asked. No expense shipping either way. Would you like to buy my bed? My next favorite, this is ultimate for me. It is Uberization of puppies. You know, puppies are a mess. I love puppies, don't get me wrong, but puppies poop. And puppies chew things. And puppies wake you up in the middle of the night. So why not get a puppy on demand? For $20... you can have a puppy for 15 minutes. And I'll tell you, if you invested that $20 and you had a puppy for 15 minutes, you'd probably feel better. It'd probably be a good form of therapy. It may be worth more than my therapy is paying for itself right now. I mean, seriously, 15 minutes with a puppy for 20 bucks. They pick them up. They take them home. There's no cleaning. There is no damage to your shoes. It is all done bingo, bango, bongo. Right?
Right here in Houston, this is a brand that's happening in Houston. There are many similar brands. Purple is happening up in the Northwest. Fuel Me. You know, it's annoying to have to stop at a gas station. You get gas on your hands. Sometimes there's a line. You have to sometimes go into the gas station and talk to the people. Why not load your information on your app like you do for Uber? Why not schedule a time for your gas to be delivered to you? Oh, by the way, the price is no greater than what you pay at a gas station. Why should it have to be? They don't have any overhead other than the fuel tanker machines. Oh, and they will write a personal note after they clean your windshield, all for the same price. You're a busy mom. It's been a busy day. You want to get home to your kids. Why should you have to waste your time stopping at a gas station? The world we live in today, folks. Persist. Engage. Innovate. Find your purpose. Share your purpose. You know, I've always ended stories about my wife's death and shared stories about my abandonment as a baby. I always like to leave in a real downer. I was trying to think of, you know, I don't really like to have my life go any more tragic. It's not like I want to have plague or locusts or anything happen in my house just so I have a story to tell. So I'd like to tell you a story that's a little happier about somebody who says, you know what, you can persist, you can engage, you can drive purpose, you can create amazing experiences, you can deliver and execute in ways that most people only dream about, as long as you want to. That's the story of this guy. His name's Ernie Andrus. Ernie is 92. 2 weeks ago, Ernie Andrus and I ran together. 6 miles together across the panhandle of Florida. The reason that I ran with Ernie is because Ernie had a cause. Ernie started his run 2 years ago in San Diego, California. His cause was to run across the United States. He's getting close. He's in the panhandle of Florida. He'll be hitting his destination in Georgia in August, a day before his 93rd birthday. Ernie wants his boat to go back to where he landed on Omaha Beach 75 years ago, coming up on 75 years ago. He's not going to make it. He is so far away from the kind of money it's going to take to do that. I'm not asking for anybody to raise money for him. That's not why I'm here. He knows he's not going to make it. So he scaled his vision down. He goes, okay, if the boat doesn't go back, then at least I want to make sure it's preserved. And anything I do raise will help maintain its preservation. People told Ernie he could not execute this particular amazingly inspiring moment. I told myself, I can't make it another mile as I was at mile five with this 92-year-old guy. And then I thought about, my team will be so embarrassed if I do not finish a 6 mile run with a 92-year-old man. So I dug down with this engaging, innovating, inspiring person, and I realized it's never too late to master the world in which we live, to find our purpose and communicate it to others, to inspire them to execute daily and consistently and ferociously in pursuit of the phenomenal. Thank you so much for your time and attention today. Yeah.